The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday the 7th of June 2019. On the podcast today, I have Graham Swindells, Chief Executive Officer of Clough Natural Resources, CLNR is the ticker there, and Grant explains what the £15 million they've just raised will be used for. Also on the podcast, I have Michael Masterman, Chairman of W Resources, WRES is the ticker there, and Michael explains the significance of the award of the mining contract for the La Perla Tungsten Project in Spain. Plus, I have Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now author of The Crypto Trader, provides some insights into the world of crypto trading. Also, I have Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the following stocks: Renault, Pressure Technologies, and Aviva. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a wealth of other content, material, interviews, podcasts, videos. Plus, do me a favour. If you use the Vox Markets app regularly and you get some value from it, even though it costs you nothing to download, then please pay us back by giving us a decent rating and review at your app store. That would be much appreciated.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Swindells, Chief Executive Officer of Clough Natural Resources. CLNR is the ticker there. Graham, thanks for joining me.
No problem. Morning, Justin.
Now, I've got to say, you've done quite a transformational fundraise of late, $15 million, pretty much. It's a big chunk, and we'll delve into what that's going to be used for and how it'll help the company in a bit. Before we do, Graham, if someone is listening right now, never heard of the company, summarise it for them, please.
Sure. Well, we're a UK-focused oil and gas investing company with a primary focus on exploration and appraisal. We've got a portfolio of seven highly prospective licences in the southern and central North Sea. We're backed by Shell, who've just farmed into two of our licences in the southern North Sea, with whom we expect to be drilling two wells in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and I think I previously mentioned to you, when you are sort of small cap, you know, oil explorer, oil and gas explorer, the holy grail really is having a major, isn't it? Farming.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There's nothing better than that.
Well, we couldn't have hoped for a better partner than Shell. They are a truly outstanding partner to have, and it's been a massive endorsement for us as a company, for the technical team and the work that they've done, and for the company strategy.
Yeah, and just reiterate there, what do you know about your prospects resource-wise?
Well, Our team has done an extensive amount of work on these licenses. We've acquired seismic. We've done a lot of reprocessing work, and we've worked them up to the point where clearly Shell, having gone through their own extensive technical and commercial due diligence process, feel comfortable to move things to the next level. Selene prospect, which is the first of the wells which is likely to be drilled, we believe that's now drill ready with full data coverage over it. In the case of Pensacola, we're going to be shooting new 3D seismic over that license in the course of this summer prior to drilling a well.
Yeah, and so you've raised $15 million. A lot of the directors, including yourself, I think, took part. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Yes.
And so take us through what this will do for the company.
Well, this fundraising really builds on a truly transformational year for the company, where we had success in last year's licensing round and added six licenses to the portfolio, and probably even more importantly than that, introduced Shell as a partner on two of these licenses in the southern North Sea. What this fundraise does for us now is it allows us to be fully funded for our share of the work program and the drilling of those wells over the next 2.5 years. So we're fully funded for our share of the exploration well on both the Selene and the Pensacola prospects, as well as investing in the work program in relation to the rest of our portfolio of, you know, the other 5 licenses we have, as well as new licenses which we anticipate picking up in the next licensing round when we hope to replicate the success we had last year.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. And so, like I said, just for people listening right now and they're okay, what's next? And what are you know, what's the next bit of news? Obviously, you can't reveal too much, but next for milestone you're hoping to tick off there.
Yeah, well, we believe there's going to be a number of significant milestones and catalysts for the company going forward. We are on the Selene prospect. We anticipate being in a position to make a well investment decision on that. Hopefully, in the second half of this year, if that's the case, a well could be drilled on that prospect anytime from the middle of next year. On the Pensacola prospect, we're going to be shooting new 3D seismic over that prospect in the middle of summer, and we have an exciting new prospect which we have worked up, and this is an oil prospect in the Central North Sea called Dure. This is one of the new licenses we were awarded last year. It's a 40 million barrel oil prospect, which we're very excited about, close to existing infrastructure in the Central North Sea. And we will be, we're about to commence a farm out process on that license, and if that's successful, that a well could be drilled on that license in relatively short order.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, Graham. Well, one final thing: if someone is listening and likes the sound of the progress you're making here and where you are in your journey, but are not following the story, please give them 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, well, we have a diversified portfolio of 7 highly prospective, low-cost, high-impact licenses in the central southern North Sea. We have an outstanding partner in Shell with whom we're going to be drilling 2 wells over the next 1 to 2 years. We're now entering into a very exciting next phase of the company's development, and we have the potential to create significant value now for shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Graham, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Masterman, Chairman of W Resources. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Justin, great to be on Vox.
Yeah, I've got to say, where are you? You're on the road, I can hear, yeah?
Yeah, I'm just in Portugal, heading up to Rigo, a tungsten mine in northern Portugal.
Oh, nice. And what's the weather like? Is it like here at the moment? It's, for some reason, it was quite nice here yesterday, but today, raining, awful. What's it like there?
Well, I was actually in London yesterday, and as you say, it was very sunny, but it's a beautiful sunny day in northern Portugal today.
You've taken the weather with you, by the looks of it. Cool. Okay, Michael, before we get into this news, La Perla is your flagship mine there. You've a mining contract has been awarded, and we'll get into that, what it means and the significance. Before we do, as always, if someone's listening to this right now, has not heard of W Resources, can you just summarise the business for them, please?
Yes, W Resources is focused on tungsten, tin, and also gold in Spain and Portugal. Our flagship mine is the La Perla open pit mine in southwestern Spain. In Portugal, we have the Régua tungsten mine development in northern Portugal, and we've got a very nice gold asset in central Portugal.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, let's dig into this. The La Perla mining contract has been awarded. So take us through this. What does this mean then, Michael?
Okay, so we just signed up with GME, which is one of the top mining contractors in Spain. I guess probably the most important thing is that the contract price for the mining is very, very much in line with the final investment decision, low operating costs for the La Perla mine. So we're able to mine at a low strip ratio and mine at low unit costs, and that puts us on track to achieve the low operating costs which underpin the project.
Yeah, and that's quite important, isn't it? You're a wanted man there, Michael, and I'll let you go in a bit, but that's quite important, isn't it? Low operating costs, especially at the moment. I suppose the resource sector commodities are taking a bit of a hit due to the China-America trade war. It's always important to have low operating costs, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I think in any resource project, you need very low operating costs, right at the bottom quartile. You need a long mine life. We're currently a jork of 11 years mine life, and that'll go up and up as we expand the resource at La Perla. And it's important to have, you know, good customers, which we have in the United States and in Europe.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff. Okay, and just remind us, production targets at La Perla and over what period of time there, Michael?
Okay, so we are in the month of June, we're finishing construction of the concentrator, which is the last large part of the plant that needs to be completed to move to large-scale production. We're looking at expanding to 200 tonnes a month with a target date of December 2019. And that'll generate around about $3 million US dollars a month of revenue at that run rate, or $36 million US dollars a year. So it's a large project, long life, low operating cost, and the ability to generate quite significant cash flows.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, and what's the next sort of significant milestone you're hoping to achieve?
So the next key milestone will be concentrator plant completion, which is targeted at the end of June. So we are in June.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, and as always, Michael, if someone's listening to this right now or likes the sound of what you're doing, but they're not as yet following the story, do you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please?
Okay, three reasons. Number one, the large-scale La Perla mine and processing plant is near construction completion. Two, during the balance of 2019, we'll ramp up to large-scale production, which will generate quite significant cash flows. And three, we have significant other assets which will follow La Perla into production and large-scale growth.
Yeah, excellent stuff. And it's good to see you are a shareholder yourself, so you're aligned with shareholders. So that's always good news. Michael, good to chat to you, and so hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, former ITV business correspondent, now top cryptocurrency trader, author, The Crypto Trader's Right Here in My Hands, How Anyone Can Make Money Trading Bitcoin and Other Cryptocurrencies. And it's got your face right on the front there.
How does it feel in your hand?
Well, your face. no, but you're almost looking like I know. You've got that look about you, say, yes, I know what's going on here.
I know the future. Yes.
Yeah.
That's me.
So let's talk about crypto. We talk about sort of, you know, you're into it. We're slowly sort of, do you know what, oddly, I don't know if it's odd at all, actually, because when you see massive spikes in share prices, it's almost a glance into the future of something. You know, sometimes it does play out, sometimes it doesn't. Now, we've had that massive spike, as we know, $20,000 pretty much in Bitcoin has come back. But now it's fell back to, what, I think, what, 3,000, around about that? It came back to something like that? But now I'm starting to see news coming out about almost crypto sort of, you know, people using crypto or companies using crypto more. So slowly, it's moving into mainstream. And so that spike almost was a foresight of where it could be. Have you seen these bits of news going around?
Yeah.
But, you know, give us a couple of examples. I mean, I've said about Facebook, wasn't it?
Yep, Facebook is going to launch its own cryptocurrency of some kind or another. Details are at the moment scant, though we've got a few little tidbits. For example, what we've learned is that they're going to bring out probably a stable coin, which is a type of cryptocurrency that is based on the price, usually of the dollar, and it's pegged to the dollar. Yeah. But the idea is that if it is a stable coin, it will still be Facebook's own kind of native currency, which worries a lot of people because, you know, who wants Facebook controlling a major world currency and being able to decide what happens to it? Though the few details that have been coming out recently sort of imply that they might try and sort of outsource it to some degree to try and separate themselves from it, to give it a bit more credibility, ironically. It would have more credibility if it's not directly controlled by Facebook. So we're expecting that maybe it will be sort of, it will sort of run itself in a decentralized way, like a lot of cryptocurrencies kind of do.
Yeah, and let's be honest, Mark Zuckerberg doesn't look human. He does look like he's he wants to rule the world, but he's just giving all the right answers, pretend he's not wanting to rule the world, you know.
That's right, he wears a T-shirt, you know, guy wearing
exactly.
a T-shirt.
Got
he's
a
just
hoodie.
A regular guy like you
I've got,
and me.
I've got a hoodie and a T-shirt, I got jeans. Yeah, yes, I'm worth billions, but I'm just like you and everyone else. And I also noticed a story on some banks, I think, using some crypto to trade. And I saw JP Morgan had used launched a while back. I did it on I do a podcast in the morning, so it's 60 seconds on macro, and I included the story, but it's gone from my mind now. But have you seen these stories and the banks starting to use these crypto?
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of thing going on. Yeah, JP Morgan working on a token called JPM coin, for example, and also now the latest thing is a group of financial firms led by UBS planning to start using a cryptocurrency to settle cross-border trades. 14 major firms, including big banks in the US, Europe, and Japan, they have created a new company that will control development of this token that will be called the Utility Settlement Coin, or USC, and they've invested £50 million approximately in setting that up. Now, so we've got them doing that. We've got the JPM coin. We've also got Ripple or XRP, which is one of the biggest cryptocurrencies, which again is a kind of centralized project between a number of leading financial institutions. And what I find fascinating about this is that it really reminds me of the early days of the internet. If you cast your mind way back when, remember how in the early days of the internet, when it was really being hyped and everybody was saying, yeah, the internet's going to change everything, all the kind of old world companies, all the big institutions that need to protect themselves said, we're going to dominate this new internet medium. We're going to create company intranets, which they all did in short order, and we're going to create B2B, business-to-business applications, and we're all going to basically take control of this internet thing, and we won't need any new internet companies disrupting things. Everything will be fine. But of course, the way things played out was that most of those old world companies have been, to at least some extent, usurped by the new internet companies, and all their industries have been massively disrupted, in some cases practically destroyed. And it will be interesting to see whether the analogy plays out again this time, because the same thing is happening. Major banks, knowing that cryptocurrencies have the potential to completely disrupt their industry, are trying to harness it for themselves and to create centralized cryptocurrencies that will allow them to keep control of the financial system. Whereas outside of that, the new cryptocurrencies are trying to, well, to usurp the big banks. That's the plan, and the banks will do anything to stop them. So it'll be fascinating to see who wins in the coming years.
Yeah, but it's odd, isn't it? Because not all currencies can win. Like I said, by its very nature, a currency has to be widely adopted by the masses to work. So all these banks are setting up. Is that what they're hoping? They're hoping to, you know, that their currency will dominate? Is that what they're going for? I don't understand.
What they're trying to do, particularly the UBS lot, is the plan is basically not to control, to take over from the dollar with this currency that they're trying to create. The idea is just to basically save them money by doing cross-border trades using this kind of internal token, if you will, instead of using standard currencies. It just, for various technological reasons, it just makes sense. Well, that's why cryptocurrencies are a revolutionary technology, because they allow all kinds of efficiencies to be made. So the idea is that UBS and all all its fellow institutions will be able to save tons of money and save themselves money and also save consumers and other businesses money by using their own internal tokens instead of using normal fiat currencies to do cross-border transfers. And that way, they're hoping, obviously, that if they make all those efficiencies and become a more streamlined operation, then there will be nothing significant for outside cryptocurrencies to bother disrupting. You see what I mean? It's like they'll have made all the efficiencies themselves, so there'll be no need for decentralized cryptocurrencies to disrupt the system. That's what they're hoping. And, you know, they've got a point. It's a brave move on their part. It's a bold move. And I can't rule out the possibility that they'll succeed, because they do, of course, rule the financial system, which gives them a massive first mover advantage over any new upstart cryptocurrencies.
Yeah. Tell me about Justin Sun.
Justin Sun is a Chinese man, a very young Chinese
29,
man.
29, I'm looking now, yeah. It's spelled yeah. Sun as an S-U-N as well. I thought it was something else, but Justin Sun, yeah. Tell me about that.
That's right. The Rising Sun, as many a headline has probably said. Yeah, yeah. If they haven't, then I'll give that one to them for free. There you go. He is the protege of Jack Ma, the founder and executive chairman of Alibaba, obviously one of China's biggest companies. And after being his protege, he set up some revolutionary companies. And one of them is called Tron. Tron is a cryptocurrency that he has invented himself, and the idea is it's a kind of decentralized social network and entertainment platform. So it has the potential, in theory, of replacing things like Facebook with a decentralized network, which isn't controlled by a Mark Zuckerberg in a hoodie and t-shirt ruling the world. It would kind of run itself. That's the idea with most cryptocurrencies, of course, is that the systems will eventually run themselves. So he's trying to create a new social network / digital entertainment platform, a kind of YouTube meets Facebook meets everything, all in one. And people would support it, and people do support it, partly because the idea is that he wouldn't actually run the thing and make all the decisions about content on the network. People would be paid automatically by the cryptocurrency for content that they upload and that kind of thing. That's the idea. But what's interesting about Justin Sun, of course, this week, you might have heard, is that he is going to have lunch with Warren Buffett because he has paid $4.5 million for the privilege of having lunch with Warren Buffett.
That would give me indigestion massively if I was him. I couldn't eat after that. I couldn't pay that. But I mean, that is crazy, isn't it? So why then? It's odd. These an old world and new world are clashing over a meal that cost him a lot of money. So who's the money? I suppose it's going to charity. It's not going to Warren, is it? I know he's sharp.
That is going to charity.
Yeah. Okay. So why Warren Buffett? That's an odd hero of his, isn't it, or what?
He says that at heart he's a value investor. Okay. Justin Sun says, and he says he's massively inspired by Warren, so he wants to give something back, in his words. You know, it's like giving something back to the community that raised you. Well, Warren Buffett is his mentor, even if he's never met him before, and so he feels like he wanted to meet him, but he wanted to kind of pay back all the wisdom that has made Justin Sun the man that he is today. But what's fascinating, of course, is that Warren Buffett is probably the biggest hater of cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, famously also anti-tech investor. He hasn't been in tech for ages. But yeah, what does he call Bitcoin?
He calls it rat poison squared. Would you believe?
That's catchy. But you know what? I love this because it's crypto. These are two different worlds colliding, because crypto, first and foremost, is seen as the, you know, sort of bubble that's got no value. A lot of people are saying it's got no value at all. You know, these got these companies that got market caps of billions, and they've got nothing apart from this sort of crypto. What's it worth? You can't really spend it anyway. Most of the coins you can't, or most of the cryptocurrencies. And yet Warren Buffett himself, like I said, I think one of his best mates is Bill Gates. And I think it was a few years back, he invested for the first time in Microsoft. But until then, he wasn't convinced about tech at all. So it's almost like it's your circle of competence. It's where you're confident investing. And he likes old industries, isn't he, and all that stuff. And he's got this guy, Justin Sun, who seems that he's a value investor. Really? How are you a value investor? Crypto is anything but value at the moment, or people argue that. So it's very interesting, isn't it? So I wonder if he won't convince Warren. I think it was a surprise recently when Warren's fund, Berkshire Hathaway invests in Amazon. Turns out it wasn't Warren himself, it was somebody who works in the fund. People were surprised. They also said, Warren's going towards tech, or, you know, edging towards it. And he said, oh, no, it wasn't me. It was, you know, somebody who works for him. So
I mean, the thing about Warren Buffett is that he has always said, I only invest in things that I actually understand, which, you know, is a sensible maxim to go by, unless you happen to just not understand the most important developing industry in the world, which was tech, obviously, back in the 90s. Mm. And he, you know, he basically just said, I'm going to just avoid this entire tech industry, and did for many, many years. And then, you know, quite openly regretted it. That's the thing. He, in the case of Amazon and Google, for example, he regrets massively that he didn't invest in them. And he admits that he was very down on them in the early days. And I mean, look, I've got a few quotes from him here, for example. 1996, Warren Buffett says, I like simple businesses. If there's lots of technology, we won't understand it. And then Warren Buffett, 2017, we avoided the tech stocks. Our worst mistake in the tech field was missing Google. We never owned a share of Amazon. We missed it entirely. I had no idea it had this potential. I blew it. And then 1 year later, Warren Buffett, 2018, cryptocurrencies will come to a bad ending. Bitcoin is rat poison squared. Mm-hmm. So I put those three quotes one after the other in my book, The Crypto Trader, at the beginning of a chapter, because I just think that is so telling. It's like he's making the same mistake all over again. He doesn't understand the technology. He didn't understand the technology of the internet. Now he doesn't understand the technology of cryptocurrencies, but he dismisses both out of hand. And I just think that's a silly thing. After he's already learned his lesson over Amazon and Google, he's doing the same again, because if he truly understood the potential that cryptocurrencies have, then he would understand that even though at the moment most of them don't, you know, there's no revenues, there's no profits, that was exactly the same with the old dot-coms in the early days, and why he dismissed them then. Just because something's not making revenues and profits right now doesn't mean it doesn't have absolutely massive potential. And I understand from a value investing point of view that is absolute anathema, but the problem is that, you know, if you want to be a true value investor, somebody who really finds those little nuggets while they're still very small, then unfortunately you do have to go into territory where sometimes there are hardly any revenues and no profits whatsoever. So there you go. That's my lesson for Warren Buffett today.
I mean, teaching him a thing or two. It's true. I mean, it's like internet companies, there are loads of them at the time. Most will fail, but the ones that prevail will do very well. Same with the cryptos, probably. And I agree with you. I did a video last night on YouTube about a company I own. It's called Bidstacks, the tech company. It's in ad tech. They got first mover advantage. They have native programmatic in-game advertising, and apparently soon Google are announcing the Stadia tonight, which is their platform for streaming games, and one of the games that they have adverts in may be announced on this platform. But I think it's a massive thing to be probably the only native in-game programmatic advertiser on Google's platform. And This share price has done very well with Bidstack. It's quite highly valued at the moment, but I've got people looking at a financial statement from 6 months ago. They'd only been listed 4 months, and judging the company on that. And they, no, you cannot do that. You've got to look where it's going, the potential where it's going, not where it's been after it's just been listed for 4 months. It's like, you've got to understand. I mean, if you're looking for, and I've said this many times, I said, if you are valuing a company on, you know, the traditional valuation metrics of revenue and profit, you'll only achieve a return of traditional proportions. So, because I mean, most companies that generate a revenue, say their profit goes up by 10%, then their share price is leveraged to that. Now, if you want truly, sort of multiples of what you've put down, you've got to look before they're even generating that, because the big move has happened before they start generating that profit, you know, and that's when they're a small cap. And so, if you can't deal with that, valuing a company that doesn't have profits and revenue, then you're not going to get the big moves. But it's more risk, but more reward. And that's the thing. If you want to save a company, fair enough. You'll get less reward, but there's less risk as well. And so, yeah, I mean, that's it. It's a circle of competence, I suppose, isn't it? It's where you're comfortable, and everyone needs to find that. I think you can find a place they're comfortable investing or whatever. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. It is the same, as I think I said last time I was on, you know, there are parallels between the AIM market and cryptocurrencies, big parallels, because you're dealing with, you know, fledgling companies that may or may not succeed. Yeah. And, you know, that's why I go on and on in my book about charts and technical analysis and that kind of thing, because the only way really with, you know, I've been investing in AIM shares for 20 years, and the only way that you can truly protect your money or give yourself the best chance of protecting your money is to just make sure that you don't hold on, you know, use basic technical analysis, chart analysis, to make sure that you don't hold on to things that are, you know, falling to nothing. It's pretty straightforward stuff, really. And it's the same with when I buy cryptocurrencies, because we know that, you know, only probably a handful of cryptocurrencies will succeed, and most of them will completely fail eventually and go to nothing. So you know, I say technical analysis, it's not really technical analysis. It's the most important thing is just to look at a chart and make sure it's heading in vaguely the right direction, and not just the company's going broke.
And risk management, you know, always know that. And listen, I've come to the stage where, you know, I've lost money, I've made money, and as I've gone along, luckily, I've sort of created a strategy and a formula, and now I have quality filters. When I look at a company, if it doesn't meet some of these filters, I just won't invest in it, because I know there's a higher risk, there's a more chance that it won't go anywhere or go downwards, you know. So I know I put them through these filters, and I'm happy with it then if it makes them. But Mark, how's the book doing anyway? How's your book selling?
It's had a fantastic week last week because an article in Forbes giving a sparkling review of the book went viral, and we had an amazing day for sales. It became the number one trading book in the UK, in the US, and in Australia on Amazon. It beat all the stocks and shares books. Wow. So it shows that there is interest in cryptocurrencies coming through. So I'm quite excited about that. Because obviously, you know, after cryptocurrencies boomed and then crashed again, as always happens with booms and crashes, whether it's stocks or cryptocurrencies or anything else, obviously interest kind of temporarily drains out of the sector. In fact, actually, when we were just chatting off air, you mentioned how interest disappears like that, and I said, in the tech crash in 2003, you know, nobody was interested in technology shares after the dot-com crash, but that was when the big profits could be made. You know, people who were buying up Amazon back then are now astoundingly rich if they held on to their shares all that time. Likewise, cryptocurrencies went through what we call the crypto winter, but already Bitcoin has tripled from the sort of the depths that it reached a few months ago. So it's coming back, and I'm excited about the future in cryptocurrency. But at the same time, I have my eyes open, and I would always encourage any potential crypto trader or investor to have their eyes open and make sure that they don't hold on to things that turn out to be duds, and that they do hold on to the best ones in the sector, and watch them potentially, as cryptocurrency people say, go to the moon. That's what we're all hoping for, that the price will go to the moon.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Cool. Crypto trader. Check out Glenn there, Glenn Goodman. Thanks, fellow. We'll catch up next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Yeah, very well, Justin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good. Well, good to be. Nice end of the week, even though the weather seems to be getting worse the weekend.
A bit average. Yeah, but we'll tough it out. Hopefully it won't spoil the cricket too much anyway.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay, let's look at three stocks then. First two are sort of like, you know, not income, but a bit more risky. So what's the first one, Russ?
The two that we've looked at before on the small cap side, Renault and Pressure Technology. So we'll do Renault first, RNO. It's just in the process of moving to AIM from the main market, about a 60, 65 million cap. We first looked at it back in February, and it's hung in there. It's gone from 28p to around 30, and you know it's a turnaround play, so it's high risk stuff, and it's a maker of chains, couplings, gears for heavy lifting and conveyor equipment. So if you want to move something around that's heavy, Renault are going to be one of the people involved there, and it's a turnaround story. If you'll forgive the expression, it's yet to hit top gear, but there are some early signs there. I mean, remember they had an awful 2017-18, operating profit halved, steel prices went up because of that fella Trump. Labour costs were going up in Germany, and they had, frankly, some internal production problems. management team introduced a turnaround program at early signs. We've had a statement come out, full year results, operating profits bounced back to where it came from, so it doubled, and on an underlying basis it was up 15%, and I think backlog up 8, orders up 6, encouraging. China factory now finished, so big investment, hopefully that will start to pay off in terms of productivity. More to do, however. They have admitted to an increased accident rate at the factory, which is obviously a bit concerning. The pension deficit's gone up a little bit, and they are still seeing wage inflation in Germany. So still quite a few moving parts here. But the good news is interest covers more than 7 times. The debt isn't maturing till at least 2024, so that's all good news. So time is on management's side. There's no dividend, but it's on around 6 times forward earnings when things aren't going that well. So fingers crossed it's going to look, you know, pretty attractive if and when things turn around. You've still got risks there. If the Chinese economy drops in a hole, or, you know, the steel tariff situation gets worse than that, it's going to be a pressure on them. But at least, again, with the valuation where it is, touch wood, you've got some form of downside protection.
Yeah, do you know what? They hit rock bottom May last year, pretty much 21 pence. They doubled then to November that last year. But they're in a range now between sort of 28 and 35 pence. If they break out, it should look quite good. But I think we've seen the bottom. It should, you know, hopefully it'll improve.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, cool. Right, what's next, Russ?
Another bottom fisher, which is Pressure Technologies. Yeah, exactly. Sheffield based 20 million market cap. So, we're definitely not talking widows and orphan stuff here. And we looked at the stuff last summer. At about 120, got all the way down to 80p, and it was like, it's had a bit of a bounce back to about a pound, I think. It's a very speculative situation. 3 years of losses, dividend cut to zero, chief executive and founder has retired. So, you know, that's why the share price has done what it's done, which is go down a long way. New management team, and they're looking to take it from 4 divisions down to 2. One of the loss-making units has already gone, and they're now in the process of confirming the sale of their alternative energy business to a Canadian fund. That has raised the money needed in a private placement. I think that deal is now going through. They're getting some cash, some stock, and they're now basically going back to where they came from, which is cylinders and precision components for the oil and gas and industrial gas and defense businesses. So it's slimmed down. You know, whether it makes money or not this year is hard to tell, but over its lifetime, it's made an average operating margin of 10%. Now, if it can do that again at any stage, it's going to look very, very cheap, but it's clearly going to be a bit of a battle. Oil hanging in there would be quite helpful, because that will start to turn the taps on in terms of oil capital expenditure. So that would be a plus, but at least they've got rid of the loss-making business. The other non-core business deal, now that looks to be happening. So at the moment, at least, they're leaner and meaner than they were. Let's just see if they get a little bit of help on the top line now.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's always a bit worrying, though, when the founder and everything steps down, and because the founder has massive skin in the game, and it's their business, and so they treat it like that. So they are a major shareholder. And then management comes in, and it's managed. They're well-paid managers, pretty much. It's bounced a little bit from 80 pence up to 1.2, but again, it's above that 200-day moving average. It's quite nice.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's gone through that. It's going down. It may use that as support now at 102, so it may be quite good. You know, it may see gradually grind up upwards, who knows? Cool. And what's the sort of income play here, Russ?
Income is Aviva. Yeah. Now, I must admit, insurance companies aren't normally my bag, because the accounts, understanding the accounts, I'm not going to lie to you, is not terribly easy.
Yes, you're not the first person to say this on the podcast this week. Chris Bailey on to talk about this.
They are
hard to look through the accounts on Aviva. So I know Warren Buffett's a big fan of insurance, isn't he? Or he was.
Well, he views it as a highly cash generative, very sticky customer business, particularly in things like life insurance, which is, you know, and Aviva is one of the UK's, if not the UK's, biggest life insurer. Mm-hmm. It's certainly more exposed to life than it is to motor and home insurance, where people can be a bit more flighty. Yeah. It's about the 30th biggest company in the FTSE 100 by market cap, and it's on the fringe of the top 10 by dividend yield at just under 8% if you assume the 32p dividend per share figure is safe. Now, earnings cover is about 1.8 times. Not bad. Cash flow cover looks to be a lot better than that, about 3 to 4 times. So that gives you some comfort. There's not much debt in there, and it's got a pension surplus. So some of the things that can put pressure on your dividend aren't in evidence. So that's a good starting point, at least. You've also got sticky customers on the life side. Now, and you've got a relatively new chief executive, Maurice Tulloch, who's come in. Now, he's reset expectations for the dividend. He said, we're only going to grow the dividend in line with profits growth. So I think we're not going to necessarily get rip-roaring dividend growth here. But frankly, if the yield's going to hang in at sort of, you know, that 32p figure is going to hang in there, that will probably be enough to keep some income seekers interested, providing you can prove that it's safe. Now, you've already seen some restructuring at the company this week. Unfortunately, 1,800 job cuts, a simplification of the business, lower cuts, costs could mean higher profits, buffered cash flow, all very helpful for the dividend. And I think investors will want reassurance here because Aviva's got form. It cut the dividend in 2009, 2012 and 2013. So I think, and you do have the regulator, as he or she is now in many industries, having a nose round, looking particularly at how insurance is priced for new customers relative to existing ones, and are they slightly taking the mick out of existing customers? So that is something that the company will need to address. But if they can convince that 32p a share divvy is safe, then a yield of around 7 to 8% might just come up on a few people's radar. With the caveat, insurance company accounting is a bit of a dark art.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It's looking quite decent. I mean, it's, do you know what? It's very similar to the first stock we looked at. It had that massive down area in, well, December it was last year. Everything sold off then, didn't it, to 360. But it's bounced up now, and it's heading towards that 200-day moving average. It's underneath it at the moment, but it's heading towards it, so it's consolidating nicely. So who knows? Who knows? You know, it looks quite good. But
good.
Marvellous stuff for us. Have a nice weekend. We'll catch
up
next week.
Have a lovely weekend. I look forward to it very much.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Dev Clever Holdings, DEV. At four, Rainbow Rare Earths. In fact, on the front page of Vox here, we got a research note by Align Research saying a Rainbow Rare Earths initiation of coverage. At three, Bidstack Group. Good news yesterday. Two of the games that their tech is in, native in-game advertising, programmatic advertising, has now been accepted or brought on to the Google Stadia platform, the streaming platform, which is revolutionary. Well, it will revolutionise the way of gaming. Of course, we've got Xbox or Microsoft coming out very soon. Lots of other companies are going to be doing streaming as well. It's transforming the way that games will be played. So Bidstack there, BIDS, a very hot stock. Been up like 95% in the last 4 weeks. It's down a little bit today, 3.3%. Just very strong price action. At two, Big Dish, again, another powerful performer last few weeks. Down today, 5%. And at number one, Keffi Minerals. I understand they've managed to secure the finance for one of their mines, I think. Okay, after quite a few years. So it's been a long time coming. Okay, top five most liked RNSs came from Predator Oil and Gas, appointment of broker. At four, W Resources, La Perla Mining Contract awarded. I talked to Michael about that, of course. At three, Keffi Minerals, central bank approval for project finance package. At two, Cadence Minerals, binding investment, AMAPA. And number one, most liked, was it most liked as well? Let's look here, they're down 6%. So always liked and not liked, so a bit of both, but one of the most read was from AAOG, that's Anglo-African Oil and Gas, an operational update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.